Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Melissa Carvel-Zimmer. It's my privilege to serve as the minister of this congregation. I'm joined in welcoming you this morning by Christina Spouty, who's serving as our worship associate, our director of religious education, Karen Lapidus, our music director, Hal Walker, and the Unitarian Universalist Church of Kent Choir. Amy Breeden will light our chalice this morning.
I'm for truth, no matter who tells it. I'm for justice, no matter who is for or against it. I'm a human being first and foremost, and as such, I'm for whoever and whatever benefits our humanity. We light our chalice this morning in celebration of the whole human family.
Spring is a time of birth, of awakening, of renewal, of growth, and of change. The earth celebrates the season in exciting colors and fragrances. Days here alternate between sunshine and rain, both of which are needed to make the landscape blossom green again, which itself lends it to the feeding of new animal life that arrives this season. We see birds and butterflies, hear insects and frogs. We know, we can feel in our bodies that spring is here, like the way you can smell when a rainstorm is coming. Our bodies awaken with a feeling of life, and so we begin again. Here in Northeast Ohio, we often get to experience the newness and joy of spring several times in the same season before it finally sticks. I appreciate that strange rhythm, though, and I think that it reflects life well. Thinking about my growth and development over the years, I see how I would start to change, and then there were some imperfections I would have to work out before I was solidly on my way to real, deep, lasting change and to awakening within. Change creates new opportunities and possibilities. Life is full of seemingly endless potential when spring arrives. Come, let's celebrate the journey and let us worship together.
After the children and the teachers go to the classroom this morning, Reverend Melissa and Christina will be leading the adults in an exploration about human rights leader Malcolm X. And I must admit that preparing for this morning's Time for All Ages was particularly challenging. I had a hard time making sense of his story and even wondered if Malcolm X is worthy of being the focus of an entire worship service. You see, although Malcolm X eventually became a strong proponent for equal rights, encouraging self-respect and dignity for the African-American community in the 1960s, along the way, he made some very poor life choices and promoted some very harmful principles. But over time, Malcolm X changed. He adopted new ways of being and of believing. He started over. Looking at the common metaphor helped me make sense of Malcolm X's story, the metaphor of the life cycle of the butterfly. And I know that some of you have diagrams of the life cycle of the butterfly. And you may know that the first phase of the life cycle is that of the egg. The mature butterfly lays an egg carefully and usually on a leaf. And then that egg hatches into a caterpillar. And the job of the caterpillar is to eat and grow and eat and grow. And it becomes a rather unattractive creature, most would think. And then it seems to know that it's time for change, and it creates a hard shell around itself and attaches itself to someplace safe. And in that hard shell, in that chrysalis, the caterpillar actually breaks down and becomes the butterfly. The butterfly breaks free of the chrysalis and spends the rest of its life in flight and mating and laying eggs. I think that we too can look at our own lives with the butterfly metaphor in mind. There is always opportunity for transformation. If we ever find ourselves doing things we know are not good or helpful to ourselves or to us, we can stop and create some chrysalis time. We can stop and consider what we need to do to change, what we need to do to transform, what we need to do to start over. So if you need inspiration, think of the butterfly and know that you too can start over.
To lead us into a time of silence and meditation and prayer, wisdom words from a colleague and also a good friend, Leslie Takahashi Morris, Marginal Wisdom. They teach us to read in black and white. Truth is this, the rest is false. You are whole or you are broken. Who you love is acceptable or not. Life tells its truth in many hues, but we are taught to think in either or, to believe the teachings of Jesus or Buddha, to believe in human potential or a power beyond a single will. I am broken or I am powerful. Life embraces multiple truths, speaks of both and of and. We are taught to see in absolutes, good versus evil, male versus female, old versus young, gay versus straight. But let us see the fractions, the spectrum, the margins. Let us open our heart to the complexity of our worlds. Let us make our lives sanctuaries to nurture our many identities. The day is coming when we will all know that the rainbow world is more gorgeous than monochrome, that a river of identities can ebb and flow over the static, stubborn rocks in its course, that the margins hold the center. Each time we gather for worship, we set aside time to widen the caring ministry of this congregation. We take time to memorialize those who have died, to celebrate with those who are joyous, and to call into this community of care those who need our love and support. One of those this morning is our music director, Hal Walker, who has something he'd like to share with you.
I'm taking this moment to announce to the congregation that for the next couple months, I will be taking a leave of absence from my job here. It's been a difficult decision, but with the support of Melissa and the board, I believe that it's important for me to do so. In order for you to better understand my decision, I'd like to tell you a little story about my health history. In my early 20s, I was an ultimate frisbee player, a long-distance runner, and a cross-country cyclist. I was a skinny guy with tremendous strength and unending endurance. In 1991, after experiencing 2 weeks of overwhelming fear, one morning I woke up with weird symptoms of fluish fatigue. One day I could run 6 miles, and the next day I couldn't run across the street without needing to lie down. As months and years passed, the doctors couldn't find anything wrong with me, but the symptoms never went away. As I became a master of managing fatigue, I identified myself as someone living well with a mild version of chronic fatigue syndrome. In 2007, on a trip to Thailand, after 3 weeks of remote villages, Thai coffee, and street food, I woke up on my last night in Bangkok with a new complex of unexplained, profound physical symptoms. I laid in bed for 2 months, some of you may remember. As the symptoms gradually improved over 6 years, I thought of myself as one of the most creative, energetic guys that you'll ever meet with chronic fatigue syndrome. This March, after a traumatic near-drowning experience in Kauai, soon after coming out of the water, I could sense a profound shift in my health. Since the accident, I've been struggling with a whole new level of physical symptoms. In the last week, I'm sad to say that I've experienced a downturn in my health. I'm experiencing chronic pain in my joints, especially my knees and my fingers. This is affecting my ability to be the musician that I am, so therefore I'm taking a leave of absence. My favorite theory about CFS is that there's a part of my brain called the amygdala that has learned to respond inappropriately to the stresses of life. It's constantly fighting for no good reason. My plan is to spend the next couple months retraining the amygdala. If you're interested, let me know if you'd like to join in on the retraining. We can start a group. In every moment, we have a choice. In this moment, I choose health. I choose gratitude. I choose presence. I choose connection. I choose surrender. I choose happiness. I'm finishing up my 18th year as the music director of this church. And I'm sure hoping for a bunch more. But for now, I need to take a little break. I'd like to thank the congregation for giving me a wonderful job to show up to.
Gracious, growing Spirit of life, we feel you all around us now. The earth is unfolding, reaching up, reaching out, reaching for the sun in a chorus of new life. May we recognize that same Spirit of life in ourselves. And let this season turn us out, turn us up, reaching ourselves for sun, for health, for community, for peace, for life. Gracious, growing Spirit of life, we know that that is your nature. Your nature is to grow and to flourish. But we also know that, like a garden, sometimes life is a little tender, especially when it's new or ill. Sometimes life is a little fragile and needs our care and attention. May we find in us also the spirit of the gardener, tending the life in ourselves, tending the life around us, so that we, our families, and our communities may flourish. Amen, and blessed be.
The reading that follows is an excerpt from the eulogy given by Ossie Davis at Malcolm X's funeral. Davis was a close friend of Malcolm's and Martin Luther King Jr., and active in the civil rights movement with his wife, Ruby Dee. He and Ruby Dee were instrumental in organizing the 1963 Civil Rights March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. This eulogy was delivered at the memorial service in Harlem, the place Malcolm most called home, after his assassination in 1965. The eulogy begins with a description of Malcolm's relationship with Harlem and with the African American community he loved. Malcolm was, of course, a champion of Black liberation, which remained a consistent focus of his throughout his life. Davis also notes Malcolm's growth and his status and reputation in the community as more than a Negro, still the common word for the time, having risen to that of an Afro-American, a goal he had for the entire community to one day share. These are Davis's words. There are those who will consider it their duty as friends of the Negro people to tell us to revile him, to flee, even from the presence of his memory, to save ourselves by writing him out of the history of our turbulent times. Many will ask what Harlem finds to honor in this stormy, controversial, and bold young captain, and we will smile. Many will say, turn away, away from this man, for he is not a man but a demon, a monster, a subverter, and an enemy of the Black man. And we will smile. They will say that he is of hate, a fanatic, a racist, who can only bring evil to the cause for which you struggle. And we will answer and say to them, did you ever talk to Brother Malcolm? Did you ever touch him or have him smile at you? Did you ever really listen to him? Did he ever do a mean thing? Was he ever himself associated with violence or any public disturbance? For if you did, you would know him. And if you knew him, you would know why we must honor him. Malcolm was our manhood, our living black manhood. This was his meaning to his people. And in honoring him, we honor the best in ourselves. Last year from Africa, he wrote these words to a friend. "My journey," he says, "is almost ended, and I have a much broader scope than when I started out, which I believe will add new life and dimension to our struggle for freedom and honor and dignity in the States. I am writing these things so that you will know for a fact the tremendous sympathy and support we have among the African states for our human rights struggle. The main thing that is that we need to keep a united front wherein our most valuable time and energy will not be wasted fighting each other." However we may have differed with him or with each other about him and his values as a man, let his going from us serve only to bring us together now.
Ossie Davis told those gathered for his funeral that they must not allow history to erase the legacy of Malcolm X. I think that that's part of my motivation for speaking to you of his this controversial figure in our history this morning. Like most people my age, I grew up honoring Dr. Martin Luther King and his contributions to our country on his birthday every year. But I don't think I ever heard of Malcolm X until I went to college and encountered him in a history class. And even then, the introduction was brief. I thought of him as a radical, a revolutionary who lived on the fringes of society. But then, when I was in theological school, I took a seminar focused on the theology and the lives of Augustine, Niebuhr, and Malcolm X. Ever since then, I've regretted that Malcolm X doesn't get more credit for his important role in the movement to dismantle racism in the United States. Had he lived, today would have been his 88th birthday. So today is a good day to look back and consider together what lessons can we learn from his life. Malcolm Little, as he was originally named, was born in Omaha, Nebraska, to J. Earl Little, a native of Georgia, and Louisa Norton Little, an immigrant from the Caribbean. Both of his parents were ardent supporters of Marcus Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Association, which was itself a controversial organization opposed to white supremacy and promoting the unification of African people globally. Neither of his parents were particularly institutionally religious, espousing instead a kind of personally defined theism that they passed along to their children. However, young Malcolm's father was a spokesperson for Garvey's ideas, and so Malcolm spent a lot of time in African American churches with his father behind the pulpit teaching Garvey's thoughts and ideas. And so he was a little confused when he was growing up. He thought maybe his dad was a Baptist preacher with his own particular brand of theology to share. Malcolm was so influenced by Garvey's ideas, especially his emphasis on self-help and the value of Afrocentrism. And you can see that throughout the trajectory of his life. His family's commitment to these ideals made them a target of racist attacks in Omaha, where they were harassed by the KKK, and then later in their new home in Lansing, Michigan, where their house was set on fire. When Malcolm was just a young teenager, his father was found dead on the streetcar tracks. The authorities said it was suicide, but the word in the black community was that his father had been assaulted and left to die there on the tracks. Malcolm's mom tried to keep the family together, him and his several siblings, but the year was 1934, and the impact of the Great Depression made the difficult job of maintaining independence even harder. Under the strain of poverty, heartbreak, and racism, his mom began to falter, and state authorities responded by swiftly intervening in the family and removing Malcolm and putting him in a foster home. He stayed in a foster home for a while before they moved him to a juvenile detention facility. Those moves precipitated his decline into a life of vice, drug abuse, and crime. Over the course of the next few years, Malcolm lived with a variety of people in Roxbury near Boston and in Harlem. He started as a hustler and user and eventually became a drug dealer and a robber. He and some of his friends were caught robbing a house, and he was sentenced to 10 years in the Massachusetts State Prison. His first few years in prison, Malcolm focused on cultivating his reputation as an angry, rebellious, and uncooperative atheist. But then, a few years in, he met a smart, authoritative, and self-possessed man whose own intellectual and philosophical foundations for his atheism made Malcolm self-conscious. He had never met anyone who could exert such influence and power with his words, and Malcolm decided he wanted to know how to do that. So with a transfer to a less restrictive prison facility with better educational and rehabilitative opportunities, Malcolm threw himself into learning. Over the course of the next few years, he would take correspondence courses in a whole host of subjects, ranging from English and Latin to history, philosophy, and religion, eventually doing more work than is required for your average undergraduate degree. He joined the prison debate club, and he was thrilled by the development of his oratorical abilities. Malcolm was experiencing an intellectual awakening, but he still had no sense of moral purpose to inform his life. However, his family back in Michigan had all recently converted to a new religious movement called the Nation of Islam. The movement held natural appeal for the family as it was built upon Garvey's principles. In some ways, it kind of picked up where Garveyism left off. His family members set upon a concerted campaign to convert Malcolm to the Nation of Islam, and in time they were successful. While he was still in prison, he began corresponding with the nation's leader, Elijah Muhammad, and dedicating himself to becoming a missionary for the movement inside the prison. In the prison, he also dropped his own last name in the favor of the letter X, which all of the members of the Nation of Islam were required to do in rejection of the slave names that they had inherited, and with the hope that one day the nation's founder, W.D. Fard, who had mysteriously vanished, would return and give them their true African names. When he was released from prison, Malcolm got his probation, moved to Michigan so he could have the support of his family and continue his work in the Nation of Islam in the temple in Detroit. That's what they were called at the time. He did so well in his duties that he began to be sent out on other missions to other temples, first in Chicago, then in Boston, then in Philly, and then eventually in Harlem. He earned the respect and favor of Elijah Muhammad, and Muhammad clearly acknowledged Malcolm X as his right-hand man, his very best minister. Malcolm was so devoted to Muhammad that he overlooked any inconsistencies in the teachings or any flaws that he saw in his beloved leader. This part of Malcolm X's story is what most people know and what most people remember. As a spokesperson for the Nation of Islam, Malcolm X focused on the liberation of African Americans from the plight of racism and poverty by any means necessary. He argued that black nonviolence and the presence of such pervasive and intense white violence against black people was a form of self-hatred. He counseled black pride and encouraged black people to stand up for themselves and to honor their African heritage. He taught hatred of white people, who he described as the devil incarnate. He was a ferocious critic of the civil rights movement, whose goal of racial integration he saw as a mistake. He favored instead racial unity of black people worldwide. His message was essentially a melding of the political Garveyite themes that he had embraced as a child and the particular doctrinal teachings of Elijah Muhammad. For many people, that's about it. That about sums up the story of Malcolm X. And I think that that's unfortunate, because the last years of his life are a powerful testament to the growth that's always possible. After his intellectual awakening, Malcolm X remained intellectually curious. He was particularly interested in learning more about the conditions that people in various African countries experienced. In response to his own celebration in print of Ghana's achievement of independence, the presidents of Egypt and Liberia sent a message to the Nation of Islam, inviting them to come and visit Egypt. The year was 1959. Muhammad, who was not particularly interested in developing international solidarity or in having many members of the nation be exposed to Orthodox Islam, was not so keen on accepting that invitation. But Malcolm was very interested in accepting that invitation, so Muhammad decided to let him go in his stead. During that first visit to an Islamic nation, Malcolm X began to realize just how different the teachings of Muhammad were from the traditional teachings of Islam. He was impressed with the display of unity he encountered amongst Muslims on that trip, and he was embarrassed at his own lack of knowledge of Arabic or even the correct forms for participating in the daily prayers. However, his devotion to Muhammad was still very strong. So when he returned to the United States, he tried to kind of reform the Nation of Islam from within to make it more authentically Muslim. That's when the language for the temples switched to mosques. Perhaps in response to both his dispatches from his trip abroad and as a result of the growing coverage in the press of the large numbers of appearances he made on college campuses, Malcolm X often found himself in conversation with foreign-born Muslims who were quite critical of the heresies taught by the Nation of Islam. The more he engaged in conversation and debate with them, the more Malcolm X began to lose confidence in the teachings of Muhammad. By 1963, Malcolm X was beginning to take little liberties in his speeches and messages that he delivered on behalf of the nation. For example, in one television program, instead of invoking the name of Elijah Muhammad, which was the standard response when people asked about what it means to be a Muslim, Malcolm X gave a more orthodox answer about submission to Allah, prayer, and fasting. In other appearances, he began to tone down the rhetoric about white people by saying that when he speaks of white people as the devil, he's not talking about any individual white person, but more about the collective historical record of whiteness in this country. It seems that the liberties he was taking with his message began to be seen suspiciously by other leaders in the nation, and human jealousies also began to be evoked as his star rose in the public consciousness. While the leaders of the nation tried to discipline him, Malcolm X began to allow himself to acknowledge the moral failings of his revered leader, especially with regard to Elijah Muhammad's sexual misconduct. Now, the story here is fairly complicated, but the end result was that Malcolm X was formally censured by the leadership of the nation and ordered to lay low and remain silent for 90 days. He tried to comply with that order, but he was realizing as time went on that they might not have any intention of ever restoring him to his role. He was conflicted. He was in a process of disentangling himself, but he still felt great loyalty to Muhammad. One of the scholars of religion who has written extensively about his work sees the Nation of Islam as a cult, and that time in Malcolm's life as the time that he was trying to disengage himself from the cult, which is very difficult for anybody who is deeply invested in any kind of cultic religion. However, Muhammad, finally frustrated and disillusioned, decided that he was going to speak out, and the nation took that opportunity to expel him from the fold. Malcolm experienced his separation from the Nation of Islam as a painful divorce. It took some time for him to recover, but then he held a press conference in March 1964 announcing the formation of a new independent organization called the Muslim Mosque. A month later, Malcolm was on his way to participate in the Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca required of every Muslim who is financially and physically able to make the trip. The seed that he might do so had been planted in his mind many years ago by some of the foreign students who encouraged him to take that pilgrimage and learn for himself what does it really mean to be a Muslim. So he decided that the time was right. And it was in Mecca that Malcolm X experienced the second religious conversion of his life. He was completely overwhelmed with the multiracial, multicultural spirit of unity he experienced on that pilgrimage. He was seized with an overwhelming desire to correct the falsehoods that he himself had taught as a messenger of the Nation of Islam. And he began immediately, no time to waste. As soon as the pilgrimage was done, while he was still traveling, he began writing voluminous postcards letters and other messages back home. In one letter to a journalist friend in the States, he wrote telling of his embrace of Sunni Islam, and he told the journalist, who then splashed it across the front page of several major newspapers, "The Hajj has forced me to rearrange much of my own thought pattern and toss aside some of my previous conclusions." He discarded his previous condemnation of whites as a whole and began arguing that white people could learn how to begin to grow and reject racism with the help of Islam. Malcolm X, or Al-Hajj Malik Shabazz, the name he took and began using after his pilgrimage, was assassinated just 11 months after his return from Mecca. Those 11 months were a flurry of activity, including two trips to Africa, where he spent about half the year meeting with leaders of various African nations to learn more about the worldwide struggle for Black people's human rights. He was so impressed with the Organization for African Unity's work promoting African independence movements that he, back in Harlem, he formed the Organization for Afro-American Unity. In the last half of his year, Malcolm X exhibited the ability to maintain the most important elements of his thought while also radically revising those aspects of his thought that he had come to reject. I understand why people who study his life are often inclined to use the metaphor of a metamorphosis. In fact, Malcolm X himself was presented with that metaphor by someone who was interviewing him, and this was early on after his return from Mecca, and he rejected that idea, saying instead that his experience had simply revised and broadened his thinking. He took pride in being a person who could, as he said, face facts and accept the reality of life as new experiences and new knowledge unfolds it. One of his biographers, James Cone, says that 11 months was really not enough time for him to fully manifest this new identity and theology that he was developing. And so who knows what he would have said about the changes in his own thinking had he had more time to develop them. But these are the facts as he understood them. He believed throughout his life that white racism was a deadly force in the lives of Black people that must be confronted and undone. His conversion to Sunni Islam did not change that. However, his conversion did lead him to grow and change, and I think that that's a spiritual lesson that we can all take inspiration from. His conversion led him to conclude that white people are not consigned to be racist, but can learn to change and grow. His conversion led him to believe in the possibility that all people could be united in one human family devoted to collective liberation. He did not believe that such a change would be easily won. He fully expected that many white people would continue to resist, even to the death. And for this reason, he never gave up his belief in self-defense. In fact, one of the things that he most appreciated about Islam was its intelligence. As he understood it, true Islam urged people to initiate aggression against no one, to attack no one indiscriminately. But if fought against, Islam gave people the right to fight to defend themselves. Now, this may still sound like a radical proposition, but in fact, that's what most of the gun owners in this country say today about why they have guns, to have the ability to defend themselves when attacked. Dr. Martin Luther King is hailed as a national hero, but as James Cone points out, King was able to be the leader that he was in the Southern Civil Rights Movement because Malcolm X was the leader that he was in the Northern Black Liberation Movement. In contrast to Malcolm X, King's leadership looked reasonable, and Cone believes that Malcolm X understood the role that he was playing, that he was a brilliant political strategist, and he understood that he made King's work seem acceptable and possible in the eyes of the vast majority of the American public. Both King and Malcolm X were assassinated when they were 39 years old. In the last year of his life, Malcolm X began to move closer and closer to King, understanding that the struggle for civil rights in the American South was part of his vision for worldwide human rights and therefore merited his support. And King, for his part, began to move closer and closer to Malcolm X in the last years of his life as he learned more and more about the racism in the American North and clearly came to understand that civil rights was not a cure for entrenched racism. In fact, in the last couple of years of his life, Martin Luther King began to tell his closest advisors that perhaps integration was not possible as a cure for racism in the North, and that maybe temporary segregation was what it was going to take in order to undo the deep, deep, powerful racism that had been entrenched in the ghettos and slums of the northern cities. Now, neither man was a saint, to be sure. Both both were sexist, both were classist, both had their struggles, that's true. But both had critical insights that I believe that we need today. The work that they devoted their lives to is not done. Collective liberation has not yet been won. The struggle for justice continues, and we're now the ones with the opportunity and the responsibility to help bend the arc toward justice for the whole human family. We're the ones with the power to help build a new way. May we seize our power and use it well. Amen, and blessed be. We have gathered in dedication to the proposition that beneath all of our diversity, there lies a unity which binds us one to the other, to the earth, and to the stars. We've gathered in witness. Let us take our witness out into the world. Go in peace.